and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to my show tonight. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedules. Tonight I have with us Ira Wallace. And Ira is going to tell us a lot of things about something that I know many of my listeners are interested in, and that is organic food and organic seeds. Some background about all of that and some things that they're doing right now that we don't realize is going on behind the scenes. So, Ira, thank you for taking the time to come on tonight. And if you would, just tell everyone, before we get started with all the details, just tell people who you are and where they can find you and your various, I don't know if they're nonprofits or what they exactly, but your various entities that you're involved with.
Okay. Hi, Eva. Thanks for having me. My primary thing that I do is I'm a worker owner at the cooperatively managed Southern Exposure Seed Exchange, and what we are is a cooperatively owned seed company. We sell about 700 varieties of organic, non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds, and we work with over 50 farmers throughout the Southeast to produce these seeds and make them available to folks at our website, southernexposure.com. I'm also a co-organizer of the Heritage Harvest Festival at Monticello, which is held every September, this year the 6th and 7th, at Thomas Jefferson's mountaintop home. And we have wonderful workshops and tastings and the opportunity to kind of see that huge mountaintop garden. It's a great event. And I'm on the board of a few nonprofits where I'm active. One is the Organic Seed Alliance, and we work to maintain the integrity of organic seeds to educate farmers about seed saving and organic varieties that are available to them. And we occasionally get involved in minor lawsuits in that pursuit against our friends at Monsanto. noted in that case were the sugar beet lawsuits and the canola lawsuits. And I'm also on the board of the Organic Seed Growers and Trade Association, which are the lead plaintiffs in a lawsuit that involves 86 farmers and consumer groups and seed companies preemptively suing Monsanto so that should we become contaminated, we can ask for remedy without being countersued for taking their GMO seeds, which we have no interest in. But the way the law is written, if it gets in your field, it's your fault. It's crazy. The last thing I do is I'm on the board of our local Virginia Biological Farmers Association, which is the organic group for the state of Virginia. And so I keep out of trouble that way, you know? When I thought I was going to semi-retire, I got on all these boards, and I discovered this work.
Well, I have to tell you, I don't read the books and things usually until the day of the show. So only today, this afternoon, when I pulled out all your stuff and started going through it, did I realize the gold mine that I'd found when I met you. I had really no idea. Really, I didn't. So I'm so glad that I landed your voice on the phone when I called somebody. That's amazing.
Well, thanks.
So one of the things that I'd like to ask you, because it interests me so much, it's not actually where I wanted to start, but we're going to do it anyway, is about Monsanto. I don't understand why, and I have a background in litigation. That's what I do. That's what I did with civil litigation. So I don't understand why it's not an act of God if a bee carries a piece of pollen from your property to the Montana's property down the road.
Well,
what is going on here?
I can understand is that you know, until the 80s, there you weren't allowed to patent life, and there was a case with a bacteria that ate oil that some guy at DuPont had invented, that he got a patent for this life form. And then, you know, after that, Monsanto and its Roundup Ready genes came in. And these patents were made for hard goods. And so the way the law is written is, like, if you have possession of this patented item, then you are... I don't know. I mean, I don't really understand patent law, but you're at fault, basically, because when they were written, they weren't talking about life forms that could be carried around by bees and, you know, accidentally fall off trucks that are driving down the road and grow and cross-pollinate with somebody else's field. So, and most of the litigation stuff that involves, you know, organic and non-GMO farmers isn't exact. I mean, like Montana said, they haven't really taken many these people to court. It's not that they do; it's that they threaten them when those farmers say they want to take action against Monsanto. And you know how expensive litigation can be.
Mm-hmm.
And small farmer just gives up and says, "Okay, I won't say anything about this. I'll just go away." And so this particular peculiarity of how a law that was made for hard physical things in the world got transferred to life forms makes it very difficult to win in these litigations against Monsanto.
That makes me so angry. It really does.
Yeah.
I always sign this petition. I don't know if they ever do any good. You know, that gets posted on my Facebook, but it just makes me so angry that to... I've written lots of letters to congressmen and senators and representatives about feeding us poison. But I don't want to have to get off on that tangent, because I will, and then it won't be, I'll just ruin our interview.
Well, it's good to encourage people to sign those petitions, because I sometimes think things are only going to change if enough people are upset about it. Going through the courts is really difficult.
What is Southern Exposure Seed Exchange? What is that?
What are we? We're really a seed company, but we started out as one person's love affair with heirloom seeds. Dr. Jeff McCormick, who was our founder, was on the board of the nonprofit Nationwide Seed Savers Exchange in the 80s, and he said, you should start a seed company because some people are interested in exchanging seeds, but some people don't know anything and they just want to buy a pack and try heirloom seeds. And the board wasn't willing to do that at that time, so he started a very small seed company with like 4 mimeograph pages. And as that developed and got interest, and we concentrate on varieties from the Southeast, then later the National Seed Savers Exchange also started a catalog, a national catalog of heirloom seeds. So what we do is we collect seeds that have been traditionally grown or that research, like, you know, some study at the University of Georgia shows this Italian variety does very well in those conditions, and we then trial them on our farm and then find a farmer or grow them on our farm to make enough of the seed available to sell it to our customers. And we do education about seed saving, and try to have a website that has a lot of education about these issues available to the public. And so that's sort of what we do. Our motto is saving the past for the future. And what we want is to make sure that our customers have the information and the seeds so that should they choose, they can save their own seeds and be independent.
So where can people find the Southern Exposure Seed Exchange on the Internet?
At southernexposure.com.
Okay.
You also have easy to find.
I'm sorry?
I said we're easy to find.
Yes. I'd also like, and you have nice seed catalogs that are available, right, online as well?
Yeah, we do. You can go to our website, and we'll send you a free catalog. Yeah. And we even have some of our seeds in stores. Not so many, but probably, 100 stores throughout the Southeast carry our seeds, mostly natural food stores and places like that.
So, and you write a blog that has very good information on it, Mother Earth News. Can you tell us a little bit? What would we find on your blog if we go there?
Well, you might find something like the last thing I talked about were different kinds of heirloom tomatoes that you might want to grow this summer. I had something not so long ago about Roselle, which is Hibiscus sabdariffa, and has been shown to be good for lowering blood pressure, and it tastes really good too.
And what is that? Roselle, Thai red Roselle, is that what it is?
Exactly.
And that's a form of hibiscus?
Yes. Yeah, Hibiscus sabdariffa.
You mean those the pretty little trees that have all the flowers all over them?
Well, this one has small flowers. They're all related. Well, the sabdariffas are closely related to okras. So this is a very pretty bush because the leaves are red and green, and it has the smaller version of hibiscus flowers. But then what's really beautiful is the calyxes swell and make these red things, which is what you make the tea out of, and they're bright red and quite lovely.
Interesting. Okay, you want to mention your other organizations at all, their websites, before we go on?
Yeah, I would. Well, one of the big things that people come from all over the country to our Heritage Harvest Festival at Monticello, and we have a website, which is heritageharvestfestival.com, and you can come this year. Steve Bender from Southern Living is going to be speaking on our Friday night thing, and Gary Fowler, who is doing the seed bank in the Carrie Fowler, who's doing the seed bank in the permafrost, is coming, so you can hear about some of these more extensive efforts to make sure that should we do very stupid things that at least some pure seed is stored somewhere.
What is permafrost? I had something in my yard one day that looked like icicles growing up from the ground, and somebody said that was permafrost. Is that what it is?
It might be. I'm thinking about in the permafrost in Norway.
Oh.
Where there's natural refrigeration.
Oh. I have the weirdest thing. I live up in the Appalachians, and my little valley is a deciduous rainforest, so we get very unique weather. And there's this one spot on the ground, and I know there's a stream underneath here. You can't see it, but I know there is. Because no matter what you plant there grows. Except when it's cold, icicles grow up from the ground like grass. The weirdest thing. So I never knew what that was. But anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Please continue.
The Organic Seed Trade Growers and Trade Association, OSGATA, is actually most actively involved right now. When you mentioned Monsanto and a lawsuit against Monsanto, which is Oscada et al. V. Monsanto, and right now our case was run out by the first judge, and we're in a circuit court of appeals right now. Like, we presented our case back in
what was the case?
March. The case is the preemptive suit against to have Monsanto not be able to sue any organic or non-GMO farmers who were accidentally contaminated. And it also means that those farmers will then be able to speak out about these things without fear of being sued by Monsanto. Because right now, they mostly don't, because when they start making noise, Monsanto makes a counter suit and says, we'll back off if you'll shut up.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, the press has the right to cover stories like that, and I'm a press, so if you want to call me.
I hope that people will cover this. We've been trying to. If you go to the website, oscada.org, then you can find information ongoing about the lawsuit.
Okay. I'm going to paste it on my Facebook if it'll come up. It must be slow because it's not coming up, but I will when it comes up. So what about the Virginia Association for Biological Farming? What is that?
Well, that is the local organic farming association for the state. We run an annual conference about organic gardening, do demonstrations about different organic farming techniques. Like, we have been looking at trap crops to take away insects from your main crops of summer squash.
But what did you say you've been looking at what?
At trap crops. That is something that the bugs like more than what you're trying to grow, so that they'll eat that instead of your main planting. And they were doing a study on powdery mildew. This is where I learned that you can use a dilute solution of milk. And not so much if once you've gotten mildew bad, it doesn't make it go away, but the first time you notice a little bit of it, if you spray that, or if you use a very dilute solution that's like 10% milk, you know, you can prevent it, and it's very interesting. So they've been doing that research for, like, I guess 3 years. And they write up a lot, you know, a lot of booklets, which are available for free download at vabf.org.
That brings up a question that I have. My passion is cutting-edge science and alternative medicine. That's actually how I came across you, because I believe food is a form of alternative medicine, primary form of alternative medicine.
Yes.
And so I know that when, perhaps as an example, that schizophrenia can be cured by giving high dosages of niacin, plain OB3.
Uh-huh.
I know that diabetes can be dealt with in, sometimes by using chromium picolinate, or there's another thing I can't think of right now off the top of my head, but just another nutritional supplement that you can take. So when you mentioned that about the calcium and the squash, I actually heard about that about 10 years ago from this man, Andy can't remember his last name, The Invisible Gardener, that's his website, I can't think of it, but he told me that when plants get funguses and certain things like that, root rot or whatever it is, it's because there is a nutritional deficiency. So calcium, therefore, would be the nutritional deficiency by using milk for the mold on squash. So do you know any other tips like that you could tell us? Because that's the only one I happen to know. I remember what he said here. But I do know that makes so much sense. If you don't have a certain nutrition, then you're prone to get a certain virus or bacteria or bug in your body. So it makes sense in plants. Do you know anything that you could tell us about how to treat these various things that get in our gardens?
Well, I'll tell you. I think for treating, you know, that... the organic gardener's friend is actually more of an offense, which is to say building the soil so that the soil can have strong, healthy plants that are able to resist. Because, you know, in most cases, for example, with beans, you can get a good crop of beans when 50% of the foliage has been removed. So you don't have to put that poison or make beans, you know, look perfect in order to have a good, healthy, nutritious crop. So learning how much damage you can live with is one thing. The other thing is building up a good amount of beneficial insects in your area. These little tiny wasps are really good at, attacking the younger stages of, a number of insects that are pests. And so we often, order the little wasp case if we don't think our population is good enough. But mostly we try to have islands of beneficial flowering plants so that there is nectar resources to keep, syphilid wasps and other wasps there so that they can help to control those insect pests.
That's a great idea. What kind of flowers would you recommend putting on the little islands?
Well, you want a variety of types of flowers, but generally speaking, the ones that are most active beneficials are small, so you want... umbrella-type flowers, something like a dill that has multiple, flower head instead of one great big flower. Those are better, or things that have, flowers down the side. You want to get sunflowers are great because they're a multiple flower. In that way, a lot of the herbs, like garlic chives and chives have nice flowers, though. Don't cut them down and stop them. Take a little section and let them, have flowers. And it looks pretty, and that also will, help with that. And black-eyed Susans, some of the flowers that you think of as wildflowers of the field are particularly...
Oh, okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. So I noticed we have a little community garden where I live, where everybody... gets together and we have classes and people to talk, and that's actually how I found out about your organization. We had some of your catalogs there. And one of the things that I've found on our tomatoes are these big, gigantic green worms that are kind of prickly. What do you do about those things? I mean, they're huge.
Like
big as your little finger,
Well, one of the things to do is you can hand pick them because they're so big and easy to spot that you can get rid of them. But, they are ones that one of these parasitic brachnoid wasps that I mentioned will parasitize. So if you see one of those going along, but they look like they have some things sticking out of them, those are eggs from the brachnoid wasps, so that they'll eat a little bit, but they're going to drop dead in another day. So, they're one of the ones that having that beneficial habitat will attract and help keep them from under control. Because, occasionally, if you have a small plant and one or two gets on there, it'll do them in. But mostly, you see them and then nothing happens. And it's because these wasps are helping you out.
Great. What do they make when they, I mean, what bug is putting them there? Is it a butterfly?
It's a little wasp called a brachnoid wasp.
Oh, that worm is the wasp?
No, the wasps are little things that fly around, and the worm...
What kind of worm is that?
It would actually make a nice butterfly if you left it long enough.
Oh, okay.
And so, if you have too many of them on your plants, they'll eat all the leaves off of it.
Yep.
So these brachnoid wasps, they lay their eggs in it, and that tends to make maybe only 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 of those hornworms grow up to be a butterfly. So you
How
still
you
keep
that
the butterflies going,
wasp?
But you don't have so many of that worm stage that you lose all your tomatoes.
How do you spell that kind of wasp, brachnoid? How do you spell that?
Let me think. Hold on a minute. I wrote some notes. B-R-A-C-O-N, brachnid, N-I-D.
Okay. I know my garden people want to know that. Okay. So the next thing is, what is the big deal about, what is a seed swap, and why is that important?
Well, okay. One of the things that gives people independence and maintains varieties that have been grown in our neighborhoods, by our families, is this tradition of saving your own seeds and then getting together, either in an informal way with, say, gardeners in your neighborhood, are nowadays more of an official seed swap. Someone who's organized advertises it. They sometimes solicit free seeds from a group like us to kind of get it started. You get some information about seed saving, maybe have someone do a workshop about it. And everybody gets together and they bring their seeds, or even ones that they had left over before, and you exchange them. And then you try to grow stuff and save some yourself for the next year. And this is a very old tradition that, used to be very common in communities. It would be a church activity or something. And what we try to do is bring that back. Like at our Heritage Harvest Festival, we have a great big seed swap, and we try to bring, some of the well-known seed savers from around the region. This year, we're going to have a gathering of the members of the Seed Savers Exchange from the Southeast who happen to come to the festival on the Sunday after. So it's just a great opportunity to meet people who are already saving seeds, to learn about that, to get some very unusual varieties. Like I got the Damon Morgan's Kentucky Butcher corn, which is this really nice multi-colored cornmeal corn from a lady at a seed swap at an event, and then later I contacted her and had her grow more of that seed to offer to our customers. It makes lovely, really tasty, nutritious cornmeal. Like one of the cornmeals that I got from a food writer and it's like you just go there and you find, oh, look at this beautiful red corn, and then they tell you the story, and then you try it and you grow it, and you're just very excited. And I get flowers. I got this basil one time. It's from Eritrea, but how I got it was from a lady who had gone to college with an exchange student from Eritrea and had been growing this like 5 years, and she was going to go live on a boat for a year, and she says, I can't grow my seeds. Here, maybe you'll want to. And you never know what you're going to get in the mail. Cool.
That's amazing. So you also teach people about equipment, how to keep old equipment going at this workshop or conference, whatever you want to call it, right?
Well, some. Not as much, more like handmade equipment that you can do. We're not as, some of the organizations, like when we have the National Organic Seed Growers Conference, there'll be more farm-scale equipment, stuff. Like when I have, when we have local seed swaps, it's more for home gardeners. So we might have plans. There's, you know, online plans. If you go to savingourseed.org, there's links to plans for various homemade contraptions for cleaning your seeds. That's kind of fun.
You, I notice also on here you have two manuals, manuals specific to Mid-Atlantic and South and a manual for the Pacific Northwest. What are those manuals and how can they help people?
Well, the if you go to the Organic Seed Alliance website, which is seedalliance.org, as I said, a part of our mission, the Organic Seed Alliance, is to make organic seed available and to help with ensuring the integrity of the organic seed supply. And one of that, the things that is involved with that is giving people, you know, gardeners and farmers the information they need to grow. And it varies. Like, for example, if you're on the West Coast, in general, you have beans. You let them dry on the vine because it doesn't rain for like 2 months, and they can dry very nicely, thank you. However, on the East Coast, you know, it's humid. Even if it's not raining, it's, you know, 95 degrees percent humidity. And so things don't dry so well. So you have to harvest your beans when they turn yellow and let them finish drying inside under cover, or you might get a lot of mold and mildew in your seeds. And so the Pacific Northwest guide has more of the particulars about what you do in that climate. And the guides that were made from the Saving Our Seed project here in the Mid-Atlantic have more of the particular details from our region. And you can go to the Southern Exposure website and get to those, too, as we link to all of those from southernexposure.com.
What advice would you have? And I promise I'm going to give you a few minutes to talk about whatever you want to talk about, okay, before we hang up. But what is some of the what's some information that you can give to people who would like to start a farm but have no money, no capital? How did you start? How did this organization?
Well, we are a cooperative community, and so how this particular farm, Acorn Community Farm, is Twin Oaks Community, which is nearby, lent the original group of people here money to buy this farm. Other co-op groups, you know, one I was involved in, you know, 40 years ago, we just put our little savings together and put a down payment and bought a farm and, you know, worked hard together to pay for it for over 5 years. So people can do that kind of thing. Right now, there are many organizations out there trying to help young farmers because, as you know, there's a graying of the American farmer. They're getting older every year, and who's going to make our food if every farmer is 60 plus? So, like in Virginia, they have several beginning farmer and rancher initiatives. When we do our Heritage Harvest Festival, we have a new farmer tent, and it's all resources. Like there's an organization, the Piedmont, here in Virginia, the Piedmont Environmental Council, and they try to preserve farmland. And one way that they do that is to try to help new farmers work with landowners for a transfer of land at a price or in a way that a young farmer could afford to have the land and continue farming. So there are many ways that people can do that. I recommend highly working together cooperatively to share resources and, you know, create a great farm for yourself.
How many people at your co-op?
We have 30 members and plus our kids. So there are a good number of us. And, you know, we have our farm and a lot of our time, though, is spent with our business and the other educational parts of it and creating the catalog and doing things like that. So it gives you quite a variety of work as well. It's not for everyone. I mean, if your interest and your skill set runs that way, you know, there's some farmers who don't like something that has a big old paperwork component to it. They just want to grow things and take it to market. But in our case, we like doing a variety of things, and that works well for us.
I think it's wonderful. So we have about 20 minutes left, and I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk about whatever you would like to talk about that you think is important for people to know.
Well, my goodness. Certainly,
whatever it is.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's rather wide open. Well, something that, you know, is certainly up for us at this point is the fight for labeling of food, especially in regards to GMO ingredients. I think that many people are not aware how much of the food that you buy in regular supermarkets have some GMO ingredients. And there's very little. Most of the research that's done on GMOs is sponsored in one way or another by GMO companies. So it's kind of hard to take it as objective. And they deny permission to use their seeds in research to scientists all the time. I mean, a lot of the good research we get comes out of Europe, where the law doesn't let them do that. I mean, before this plant patenting, you know, even though you had, a PVP, you still had to make your seed available to researchers to find out things about it. But that's not true with this GMO patents. So I think that it's important that people support labeling, because then they have to make the information available so that consumers will choose that food if they can prove that it is safe and healthy, which I highly doubt, given the amount of additional allergies that have turned up all of a sudden at the same time that GMO foods have become widespread throughout the food system.
Recently, in September, I had a massive heart attack, and so my way to treat my heart attack, I think I told you this, is I'm trying to be holistic. So I live up in the mountains, in the Appalachians, and in a little small farming community. Of course, that we have whatever that poison spray is on everything up here, except for a little group, pretty much. Uh-huh. And so I go to the grocery store, and I pass the manager, goes, "Are you finding everything you need?" And I'm, "Yes, thank you." And then all of a sudden, I stopped in my tracks, and I said, "Excuse me." And I burst into tears, and I said, "No, I'm not finding everything I need. I'm walking in this grocery store, and I'm starving because I can't find anything to eat. It's either full of corn, high fructose corn syrup, or sugar. Please, please get us something that's worth eating in this store." And he caught him off guard, but I feel like that some of us are starving because we can't find anything to eat for that very reason. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, who is Gary Mabin?
Yeah, I think that that's really important.
You say there are a lot of people actively involved in seeds who know a bunch of stuff. Gary Mabin, who is that? What is he doing?
Well, what do you mean actively involved in seed? Well, you know, I mentioned the organizations that are involved, like the Organic Seed Growers and Trade Association and Food Democracy Now, are very active in this anti-GMO lawsuit, and very actively involved in trying to get labeling of GMO products so that people can know, and trying to have more organic products available all over the country. For my particular, as an African-American person, one of the things that is a particular interest to me is to try to have organic food available in these food deserts. I mean, you know, some organic food is expensive, but if you're talking about things like, you know, carrots and potatoes and stuff, they're not that much more expensive than other carrots and potatoes. And they, you know, basic foods should be available without poison everywhere. And, you know, so we try to be involved with that and with having programs that, you know, have those regular foods available in these little markets that are in the middle of the city. So that's something that we work on. And actually, our little Virginia biological farmers worked with all of the farmers markets in our state to try to have them all accept, you know, WIC and stuff like that so that people could get real food with a benefit and not just something full of sugar and nonsense. So, yeah, I'm all with you in that case. And you can, you know, go to these websites like oscada.org or seedalliance.org and, you know, find out more information about that. And you can start a seed swap. We have on our website, and Mother's News has on their website info about how to start a seed swap in your own town so that you can, you know, share seeds, you know, with your own community. And really, if you have a nonprofit trying to start a community garden in your area, companies like ours will, you know, help you by giving you seed to help start, you know, the community gardens or community, you know, seed library or any of those kinds of efforts as well.
So could you tell us a little bit about, we have about 10 minutes or maybe 12 minutes, fertilizers? Because I'm looking at something on one of your pages that's talking about things that have those three prominent numbers, 10, 10, 10, or 5, 10, 5, and nitrogen and high carbon materials. Could you talk to us a little
bit? Well, I think that compost, there is nothing that is wrong with an organic gardening that compost won't help. So even though it's not a very high in nitrogen or one of those things, the thing about it is it has balanced nutrition, has nutrition that is let out slowly over time. It changes the soil texture so that your plants can get more of the nutrition that is actually already available in the soil. Something that you can do that, you know, is a more traditional thing that really helps is you can check the pH of your soil. If the pH is, which is, pH is a measure of, the exchange of ions. But what it really is something that lets you know how well your plants can pull up nutrition out of the soil. And it's a thing that's pretty, at least for the kinds of soils that we have here in the Southeast, which are mostly acidic, is pretty easy to change. You can use crushed limestone, and it will adjust the pH slowly. And suddenly, you might have twice as much, you know, especially phosphorus and potassium available from your soil without adding additional fertilizer. So we like to add a lot of compost, add organic material, grow your own nutrition by growing cover crops of rye or oats or winter peas or clover in the winter. And in the summer, you might want to grow something like buckwheat or crowder peas or soybeans and turn it under when it's green to make a green manure and build nutrition in that way. Old hay turned in. You can take leaves are great in the fall. They're a great source of additional nutrition. And, it, you know, when you put them in big clumps, they take a long time to break down. But I often take a metal trash can and put the leaves in there and take a weed whacker and run it, and it chops them up into little bits so that you can mix it in and buy spring that has been incorporated into the soil. So those are, you know, some things. And you can use, if you really, look around in your area, there's other organic material that you can get free, like coffee shops will often give you the coffee grounds, and they make a good addition to your garden. You can, some people shred up paper and compost it. Because, you know, paper is made from trees, so there's a lot of organic material in there.
Does the, so, the paper not matter?
Well,
just curious. I'm not debating.
I'm sorry. What did you just say? I couldn't quite hear you.
The ink and the paper.
Right. We don't use colored ink paper. We use newsprint and other paper that has just black ink on it. Office paper is often really good. And if you have an office near you, even though computers are supposed to take away the need for paper, they get rid of tons of paper that they have printed stuff on and don't need it the next day.
What about ashes from your fireplace if you just burn wood?
You can use ashes. You just need to be careful about how many ashes you're putting out at a time, because you could... because the way that people used to make potash is by pouring water over ashes. So, you know, but if you're talking about small amounts of ashes spread so that you're just having a thin layer, that's excellent.
I said it. We bought our house from this man, and he said, oh, you just need to put potash on your soil, and you can get that by just taking your ashes from your wood stove. We have a wood stove that we use in the winter a lot. You can just take your ashes from there and put that out on your garden, so that's not really right.
Well, as I say, it is, gardening is a matter of balance. So, yes, some amount of ashes can be good. No, if you have a little, 5x15 bed and you're going to put all the ashes that you had from the winter, that's not going to work.
What is it that the ashes put in there? In the ground.
They do have potassium.
Okay. And what does potassium do for the plant?
Well, what I think of it as doing is it's really good for the fruiting characteristics of your plants. Like nitrogen is good for the leaves and the green part of it.
Okay. Huh? I put too much nitrogen one year, and I... It was so funny. I had tomatoes that were looked like a jungle. I'm not kidding. In this little, maybe
any
3x4 spot, and they were as tall as my house, literally. And voluminous. I can't even begin to tell you, but no tomatoes on it. And so I learned about
it. Exactly. Yeah. So your potassium helps you with getting that fruit, and your phosphorus makes nice roots. It also is good for the fruit.
How do you get phosphorus? Is there what natural way?
Well, mostly from ground up phosphate rocks. Rock phosphate is what the easy thing that they have, and then there's a certain amount of it in your compost. This is why I say compost is good for what ails.
Okay. So you got about 6 or 7 minutes. You got anything else you want to talk about?
Well, one thing is that a lot of people don't realize that gardening and growing food in the spring and in the fall is like some of the easiest thing. And it's a time when you can grow a lot of food in a small area, because what is usually growing then is greens. So you can take those greens, do your summer planting, late summer and early fall planting, so that you have first, your broccoli and cabbage and stuff, but collards and spinach and kale and things that will last all through the winter. You can just plant as other summer things kind of get bedraggled and aren't producing that much, take them out. Put some compost in and put those greens in. And you can use floating row cover, which is a spun polyester fabric, to cover them and be able to harvest all winter, even if you don't have a greenhouse. And I think that that is a wonderful thing, and you can get a lot of food from a small area because you can cut those greens and then let them grow some more leaves and cut again.
So,
and there's not very many bugs in the winter.
You grow, like, green things like that, you can cut them and they continue growing like grass?
Well, as long as you have to notice where the growing point is. Like, for most of them, it's the middle. So you're going to cut no more than 40% of the outside leaves of a particular plant. And then you leave that one to grow back more leaves. And you go back. So that's why in the winter, our garden is about half the size of our whole summer garden, because it's just all kinds of greens that we can go out there and we'll harvest one row. And we might not go back to that row for 8 weeks. And then another row and another row. And with the
I hate to admit it, but I have a microwave in my house because my kids just won't live without it. I mean, it's just like a war zone if I don't have a microwave. And I hate it, but it's a fact. And I have a lot of seeds that I'd accumulate over the years, and I made the mistake of putting all these seeds in a big, giant 3-gallon baggie in little individual bags, but I made the mistake of setting them on top of my microwave. And then I had a heart attack, and I forgot about them. So people have been microwaving, and my seeds were sitting on top. Does that mean all my seeds are probably dead?
Well, it's according to how good your microwave is. If it's really good, it should have shielding that will keep the microwaves from going out the top. But if it's not good enough, maybe they won't be so good.
Oh, man, makes me sick.
But you can, really, you know, the way you can try is you can do a little germ test with a piece of newspaper, I mean a paper towel, spread like 10 seeds in the paper towel, moisten it, roll it up, put it in a Ziploc bag, put it somewhere warm like on top of the refrigerator, and, you know, have a spray bottle to give it more water as it needs, and check of them every 2 or 3 days. If they all germinate and look right, they're probably fine.
Okay.
And if they don't bother wasting your time planting them in the ground.
Okay. Thank you. Because I was worried about that, and that gives me something to know whether or not I need to go out and buy all my seeds or not. We have about 3 minutes, and maybe you can take these 3 minutes to just give the small-scale gardener some varieties that they should look for to get the most out of their harvest.
Okay. Well,
then make your last sentence your website again, okay? And you've got about 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay. Well, we'll try that. Things that are easy for new gardeners to grow are greens, as I said. You know, they might want to grow kale. We love lacinato. We also like the Vates kale for the winter. We like collards because we're good southerners. And there are a lot of different kinds. One that you may never have tried before is called green glaze. It looks quite shiny, and it's nice. It doesn't get as many insects as some of the others because of that shiny characteristic to the leaf. We love green beans. We like pole beans, like the old-fashioned Kentucky Wonder. We like cornfield beans, like the Cherokee cornfield bean. And we like just plain old bush beans, like Contender. We grow Graminelli's mushroom bean. That's a yellow pole bean, and folks say it tastes like mushrooms. It's delicious. I love to grow cucumbers. One that we like is called Arkansas Little Leaf, and it's nice because the leaves are small, so the cucumbers don't hide from you and get to be baseball bats before you find them. And I like old-fashioned summer squash, like yellow crookneck or golden patty pans. Gosh, there's so many things to do. Watermelons. Well, especially down here in Georgia, watermelons are great. We love crimson sweet watermelons. We have some little ones called Catania that we like pretty well. Sugar babies are nice for people who are in town. You can even run those up on a rack. Are we getting near the end? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And you know what? You can find these and other specialties like Radiator Charlie's Morgesbusters. So you can get a one-pound tomato at southernexposure.com. And, yeah, and if you want to come and taste all these yummy things, you can visit us at theheritageharvestfestival.com and come on up to Virginia and see us.
Now, I just want to tell everybody, our site is a beautiful site, the Seed Alliance Star 4. Well, all of them are beautiful, or southernexposure.com. I'm not sure there's so many of them, but they're beautiful sites. Everything you want to know and more. And also, be on the lookout. It might already be ready. Ira's got a book coming out, Guide to Vegetable Gardening in the Southeast. Is that ready yet?
Yeah, it's not going to come out until December, unfortunately. It takes a long time between writing it and it getting out.
No, I got one. It just came out in September, my second one, and it's like, You get sick of reading your own stuff, you know? But
yeah.
For the trees. But anyway, everybody keep an eye out for Ira Wallace's new book due out in December of this year by Timber Prescott, Guide to Vegetable Gardening in the Southeast. Ira, you're the greatest. I so enjoyed having you on my show. I hope you'll come back again and maybe even consider speaking via teleconference to our group here in our little community sometime.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I look forward to doing something with you in the future.
Thank you so much for what it is that you do, and have a good night.